Progressive Radio Network, the number one network for those who care about the truth.
Hi, everybody. I am Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, or catch all of my shows in the archives. You can find my archive programs at the Progressive Radio Network website, or you can call my personal archive phone number to hear the most recent 5 episodes of It's All About Food. Here's the number: 1-701-719-0885. Here it is again: 1-701-719-0885. Learn about how we can solve many of the world's problems today and do it deliciously here on It's All About Food.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Now you masters of war, you that build all other guns, you that build the dead plains, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, just want you to know that I see through your mask. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly like the Judas of old.
The great folk singer Odetta with Bob Dylan's Masters of War. It's from her 1965 album, Odetta Sings Dylan. Interestingly, Bob Dylan, who, as you know, recently was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, that's just last year, credits Odetta for inspiring his love of folk music. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're going back to the discussion that we had a couple of days ago. We were talking about General H.R. McMaster, as you remember, the U.S. National Security Advisor. And talking, he was talking about the art of war, to put it mildly. How wars are to be fought. And this discussion was held in 2014. However, we saw how applicable it was to the U.S. bombing of Syria and the conduct of the United States as a whole in these latest developments of war. One of the things that you may want to keep in mind is that General McMaster and others, he's not the only one. In this new administration, the military as a whole, they have a new opportunity to grab somebody, a new president, and to formulate, to insinuate themselves within the administration, which is why we did that program questioning whether Donald Trump had been captured by the intelligence and military communities. And we see, in many ways, that the president has adopted a whole new attitude about war. He's very, very aggressive about war. He has done things that no president has done in such a short time. I mean, you come close within your first 100 days of sparking World War III. With the new attitude and the new theories and the new methods being advanced by the advisors. But one thing remains remarkably the same, and that is the lying. The lying, the deception, the misinformation, the disinformation, all of it in service of maintaining military dominance. The White House has said that President Donald Trump's April 6 cruise missile airstrikes on a Syrian airbase and other military installations was in retaliation for a chemical weapons attack by President Bashar al-Assad on his own people in Khan Sheikhoun, a town under the control of rebels battling Assad's regime. 90 people were killed, 500 injured in that attack that President Trump and his military people insisted was carried out by Assad himself and directing, of course, his military to do exactly what was done. But the U.S. attack was a false flag operation based on military intelligence that was, quote, obviously false, says noted Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor Theodore Postol, who has joined a growing group of highly credentialed experts questioning Trump's explanation for his military attack on Syria. Now, these people, we played the tape of McMaster explaining the methodology of war, how best to conduct a war, what should be the disposition of the commander-in-chief and the military and the soldiers, everybody, our resolute commitment to not allowing, not giving ground to anybody. You must vanquish the enemy. You must use, as he said, maximum brute force. In other words, by any means necessary, you ought to win and be prepared to win psychologically. This is very, very important. Well, one of the constant characteristics of U.S. war methodology is lying and deception. And we are seeing now and more scientific people, experts at this kind of thing, weapons, chemical weapons experts, coming forward and saying there is no way that A, this was an Assad-directed bombing, or gassing, I should say, of this small town. And B, this was not the gas they said was used. It would have killed a lot more people, and especially the first responders. But more importantly, the evidence itself flies in the face of anything coming close to a description of what the remains of a poison gas canister would look like. It was clearly a setup. It was clearly not dropped from the sky. It was a ground operation. So on so many counts, what they are saying, these experts, they're coming forward now more and more, they're saying this was a false flag operation. This was false intelligence. And this brings me back to that a small tape that we listened to, that small portion of the tape of General McMaster. Because he talks about how you have to have people trained and in place, and how you take control of the war, not the other way around. The war should not take control of you. Now, he's an advisor. Don't forget, he is one of the principal advisors in the conduct of war to the President of the United States. And we heard Donald Trump, whether he slipped up or whether it's just part of the way he sees the world, he refers to the military as his army, my army. This is what we did. And he's very proud of what his army did. Well, let's listen here to a brief conversation that this professor had, Theodore Postol, with RT, that's Russia Television. And he's talking about this very thing, that there is no evidence at all that the scenario that Donald Trump and others painted about this gas attack in Syria that basically warranted a heavy response, which was, you know, to come a couple of days later, the U.S. Army, the Navy being positioned in other parts of the world, ready to do their parts, I should say, in the relay, the military relay that has been planned, which includes a possible attack, preparation for a possible attack on North Korea. We know that there was an attack in Afghanistan where the so-called mother of all bombs was dropped. All of these things, all these actions were predicated on what was disseminated by none other than the president himself, that it was Assad, essentially, who started the whole chain of events by bombing his own people. And so the United States had to step in and respond militarily and respond also to anybody else, any other country, including possibly Russia, including possibly China, who might have gotten in the way, by supporting the view from Assad that it couldn't possibly have been him. So we're going to listen to this short interview, and we'll come back and discuss it right after that.
A professor at the respected Massachusetts Institute of Technology is joining the growing list of those questioning the alleged evidence of the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons in Idlib last week. Professor Theodore Postol reviewed the White House intelligence report, which was declassified Tuesday, and says what the administration believes to be irrefutable evidence is, in his opinion, inconclusive. RT's Alexei Arshevsky spoke exclusively with the professor. Here's the rest of his interview.
Professor, you also said in your assessment of this report that this draws the analogies back to 2013 when the accusations against the Assad government of using chemical weapons in Ghouta attack, killing more than 100 people. You were actually investigating 2013 incident as well and came to conclusion that the U.S. intelligence may have been wrong there again. Can you specify what kind of analogies that we're dealing with here?
I think this is an indication that there is something extremely problematic in the American national system with regard to the use of intelligence. This particular report is in some ways exactly parallel to the report that occurred in the Obama administration. Factual claims that could not be true. Let me give you an example. They claimed that the American infrared satellites saw the launch and impact of the sarin munitions that were used in that attack. That is not possible. The American infrared satellites are very good, and they could certainly see the launch of a rocket, but they could not tell where the rocket landed because there was no explosion when the rocket landed. They would only be able to see the flash from an explosion. So this is overtly wrong. And no American intelligence expert who knows anything about their business would have argued that this data was available. So that was fabricated. But what it indicates is a willingness on the part of high-level people in the White House to distort, to use intelligence claims that are false to make political points and political arguments. And this is a serious, intolerable situation.
Professor, I covered the G20 summit back in 2013 when Obama came to St. Petersburg in Russia to rally support for a possible ground invasion in Syria. And then the premise was the alleged attack by Assad government on Ghouta, the chemical attack. Now we're, as you're saying, we're facing a very similar situation. Do you think it can actually go into investigation on the ground, something that Moscow has been demanding?
What I think a rational approach would be for there to be two investigations. There should be an international investigation, probably under the UN, since both the Russian and American sides have at some level vested interests, but some organization like the UN, where of course the Russian and Americans can provide their input and their arguments. And then there needs to be a second investigation. This would be an American investigation. And we need an investigation into how such a false intelligence report could be generated at the highest levels of our government. This is very serious. This confrontation with Russia has some potential to escalate. And if it's escalating over false intelligence claims, that is very serious. And in addition, I would argue that such an investigation of this report should also include a complete investigation of what happened when Obama was initially misled into thinking that there was an attack by the Assad government. We know that Obama was told after he initially believed it was the Assad government, he was told that it was not necessarily the case. So he was initially given incorrect intelligence, and then it was corrected, although the public was never told about this.
Okay. What Professor Theodore Postol, who is regarded in the field of chemical warfare as something of a global expert, he's a professor emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. What he's saying, in effect, is that here we have yet another instance of the intelligence and military lying not to just one president, but to two presidents. President Obama, who you may recall bombed Syria, 2013, under the same pretext that Assad was chemically attacking with chemical weapons his own people, Syrians. They happened to be located in towns or villages that were virulently against him because they were occupied by rebel groups. So Obama initiated war on false pretenses. And those pretenses were false, coming from his intelligence people, his military people. Here we have the new president, the new guy on the block, and he couldn't be more agitated about the need to just blow all of Syria off the map. And that decision, which he then was popularizing all over the country, which was the rationale for engaging in this unapproved action, this unapproved by Congress, same as with Obama, unapproved. Although I must make a distinction, Obama at least sought permission, sought authority from Congress. They just did not vote to give it to him, but he sought that authority under the law, under the constitutional provision that we have in place in the United States. They just decided, no, we're not going to give it to you. But here we have a second president, and we're just talking now within a time frame that we easily can relate to and can easily recall the details of, because heaven knows how many other presidents were given false, deliberately given false information by their own intelligence, by their own army, specifically for the purpose of starting wars. I'm not hearing the question being asked. We heard that sentiment coming from McMaster in that short piece, which is why, you know, you have to connect dots. It reflected his thinking that all the reasons when you attack forcefully. You attack to make sure that you take all decision-making powers away from the enemy. You use maximum brute force. Well, that's his version. He is a professional soldier. But for whom? And how is it that we can have a president who is already, way off center, personally, who hasn't read a book, and he's proud of that. In other words, he has no independent way to evaluate the information that he's getting, so as to know whether he's making a wise decision or not. He has been isolated, and he is being run by a whole different order that has its own agenda, that is putting its peoples very, very strategically in place. So when they decide it's time for a war, because war is such a great energizer to these folks, they already got from Donald Trump $54 billion extra to ramp up their stack of toys. We discussed already, it has not been made clear to the public, we discussed that one of the things you heard him tell that story, McMaster, in which a general
talks to a president about a goal. And the president says, this is going back now to the Vietnam War he is referencing. And the general says, well, in order to accomplish your political goals, I will need 150,000 soldiers. And the president says that for political reasons, I can't give you 150,000 soldiers. And that's when he came back and spoke in a parable of sorts, that if you had a small business and it was failing, and you went to a bank and you asked for $150,000, and the banker says, I can't give you $150,000, but I could give you five. The dilemma now is, will you take the five or will you hold out for the $150,000? What he was saying, and the reason I played that, was to see the analogy being made. In order for the generals or whoever is making these geo-military decisions, in order for the military to have some degree of success in a particular region in the Middle East, they need at least to have 150,000 of some mother's sons on the ground. They haven't announced it yet. But the question comes in to set the whole thing in motion. You have a false flag operation, and they knew it. They had to have known it. Whether they told Donald Trump or not, we don't know. But they carried out a whole thing that presented the scenario in which the president not only will be called upon to act, but will likely act the way they want him to act, so as to begin the chain effect that puts us in a protracted war. See? And this is why you listen to lead stories, because things look unconnected, but they're not. You have to listen to what people are saying. They're telling you things they may not even know. And that's where we come today. We have to ask the questions, and we need now a whole bunch of questions answered immediately. Now, it couldn't just be the case that this professor and others who are experts, considered world-leading experts in this kind of thing, it couldn't be that they were right on everything else and just on this one thing they're wrong. He is saying, and others are saying, this is a false flag operation. Now he's saying, we need to have a couple of investigations, not just one, but a couple. We need to have some questions answered, because nothing that is being said is lining up with the evidence. You said that Assad did it, but you can't prove it. Remember, we spent so much time talking about that. There's no proof that he did anything. You said that they use sarin gas. You can't prove it's sarin gas. You're not able to prove it. You said the poison gas was dropped from the air. He's saying that is not what the evidence shows. Something might have been dropped from the air, but not this. This was a ground operation, and all the more reason to prove that it couldn't have been sarin gas, because there's no way you could set off sarin gas at ground level and survive. There would have been a whole bunch of seriously dead people, and that was not the case. So this was something else. So now the investigation should ferret out the truth, and we should demand the answers from Donald Trump. And this is why there are constitutional built-ins that a president just can't wake up one morning and decide, based on the recommendation of his war-hungry advisors, that it's a great day to start a war. They get to test all their theories. They get to see all the things they talk about hypothetically, literally in action. They get promotions, as McMaster just recently did. And he now has very, very, very close contact with the president. This never happened before. We talked the last time about this particular military advisor talking about the benefits of where you place politics within war. You see, the relationship between politics and war. So we can't discount any of this at all. The basis of all of this is what we know to be true. Governments lie. You can't trust a thing they say. And you certainly see now we have reason to revisit the question, is Donald Trump a captured man? Captured by the deep state and the military? And will he be used to drag us all and half or three quarters of the world into one big old conflagration? I'll take this break. We come back and we'll talk about Haiti next.
You lie, you deceive. World war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the waters that run down my drain. Fasten the triggers.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're talking now about a country that has accounted for a great deal of interest by this program and its listeners, and that is Haiti. After almost 13 years, a multinational military force sent by the United Nations to stabilize Haiti is being phased out. Both inside of the country and in the Haitian diaspora, there's great concern about what happens after the troops are gone, and even before they do go, how will a number of lingering issues that had caused great tension between nationals and troops, how will they be resolved? Kim Ives is a familiar voice here with us. He's co-founder of the international weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté, and he's here to discuss this tenuous transition. Hey, Kim, how you doing?
Great, Eutrice, and how are you doing? You're really soldiering on despite adversity here.
Thank you. I'm hanging in. Having surgery soon on my arm. I told you about that. And hey, again, I'm milking it for all I can get. I'm trying. It worked on you. Look, what is this thing about the UN forces brought into Haiti to stabilize it? How did they get there? Why were they there in the first place? And why are they leaving?
Well, I was reflecting just now, listening to your reflections on the false flag operation in Syria. And it was reminding me of a famous quote by the Prussian general Clausewitz, who said, "War is just the continuation of politics by other means." And there are two types of war, I think, that are carried out. There are the hot wars, the proxy wars that we've seen in Syria and Ukraine and Yemen and Iraq and Libya. But there are also the low-intensity wars, the low-intensity conflicts that we see throughout much of Latin America. And Haiti, to me, is really perhaps the model for that. It is the only nation in the Western Hemisphere that has or ever has had a multinational peacekeeping force, which is simply the new way that the U.S. empire manages its neo-colonies. It used to be through the local armies, whether it was Pinochet or Somoza or Duvalier or et cetera. But they found that this didn't really work because the generals were corrupt and the armies were brutal, and it created many Che Guevara's and revolutions and was not helpful. But this internationalist group with which the deep state is so closely connected in the U.S. Has devised this new paradigm of letting the U.N., let the soldiers of other similar countries go and police the more rebellious ones. And in this case, the rebellious nation is Haiti, and it always has been. It was, of course, the first nation of the Americas to break the chains of colonialism at the strongest link. Napoleon's army was the strongest army and mightiest army of the day, but the formerly enslaved people of the colony of Saint-Domingue rose up and defeated their army and established Haiti. And that was, of course, the nation that gave Bolivar the guns and ships and printing presses and troops to liberate the continent. And it also redrew the map of North America. The Louisiana Purchase was obtained because Napoleon lost Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti. And hence the United States doubled in size. So I think the international group has deployed the peacekeeping forces in Haiti for these past 13 years, which is really the second time. We have to say there was a UN occupation of Haiti from 1994 to 2000. And that was, I think, unsuccessful in sort of breaking the back of the resistance in the country. They had deployed that basically to counter the nationalist movement that sort of grew behind President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And they withdrew it, and Aristide came back, so they had to redeploy it this time for much longer, from 2004, when the second coup against Aristide was carried out, until today. The interesting thing here to note is that the mainstream press, and, you know, they do this sort of brainwashing through force of repetition is saying, oh, the occupation or the peacekeeping force in Haiti is over. It's over. It's over. Well, it's not really over. Although the UN Security Council on Thursday voted to renew MINUSTAH, as the current mission is called, the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti, they renewed it for the final 6-month period from April 15th to October 15th. So the 3,200 soldiers and policemen who are there are going to be gradually phased out. But they are going to be replaced in October by a new mission called MINUJUST, which they say, oh, it's just policemen. But policemen are just a form of soldier, as are inner cities and suburbs, working class suburbs of the United States know. These police soldiers will be between about 1,300 and 300 and will be deployed from October 15th on. So basically, Haiti remains a state which is occupied, and these troops, the UN Secretary General makes no bones about it. This force is there to monitor and to provide electoral oversight and reform and good governance, political stability. Here are all the words, the codes that they're using to describe what they're doing in Haiti. Now, all of this is completely illegal. By the Haitian Constitution, it explicitly forbids any other armed force other than the Haitian army and the Haitian police. It says no other, quote, no other armed corps can exist in the national territory. So they're trampling the Haitian Constitution, kicking it to the side. They never even mention it. And what's even more brazen is the way they trample their own hallowed UN charter, which specifically says that the UN Security Council can deploy these quote-unquote peacekeeping forces, and we'll talk about that in a minute, these peacekeeping forces in the case of international conflict. That is the fight between states. If Israel and Syria or Israel and Lebanon are fighting, now they can deploy them. Of course, they never deploy them then. But in the case of Haiti, which is a purely internal conflict, Haiti's not at war with anybody. And yet there are the UN peacekeeping forces. So they're violating even their own UN charter. It's even by international law illegal what they're doing.
I want to ask about the relationship between the deployment of these international forces, these peacekeeping forces in Haiti, and Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Clinton is, as your listeners surely know, one of the archetypal representatives and mouthpieces and frontmen for the deep state, for this international list sector of the U.S. bourgeoisie, if we can even call it U.S. He is in many ways the Svengali, we could say, of the international, transnational elite, you know, bringing in all kinds of different international players together, from Carlos Slim in Mexico to this Singapore magnate to that Bulgarian magnate. So he's got all kinds of wheeling and dealing on the ruling group area. But also, I think he was a complete proponent of the UN forces. And in fact, he was the person who in 1994 brought Aristide back on the back of 20,000 U.S. troops And those U.S. troops then passed their military occupation of Haiti from October, actually they invaded in September of 1994. They brought Aristide back in October, but they stayed until 1995, the month of June, I believe it was, and they passed it off to the U.N. at that point. So I could say Bill Clinton was the pioneer of using the U.N. peacekeeping force to militarily occupy Haiti. Haiti had been militarily occupied originally by U.S. Marines in 1915 until 1904, but Clinton was the one who revived the occupation under the using the UN as proxy in 1994. So when the second coup against Aristide took place, Bush, George Bush, George W. Bush, also revived and used the UN to militarily occupy Haiti. So I would say both Clinton and Bush have been the principal, how should we say, architects of the UN occupation of Haiti.
But it also was, I would contend, it was also the beginning or an introduction of the Clintons, Bill and his wife Hillary, who would then be Secretary of State under Obama. It gave them an incredible familiarity with the country and the power that they would have. They would, in effect, be protected by these very troops if it came to it. But it gave them an extraordinary idea of how to set up their endeavors and their business arrangements in Haiti that would still be protected by this international force. It didn't happen right away, but it happened soon after the first coup with of Aristide. Would I be incorrect to say something like that?
No, I think that's correct. I mean, in essence, the UN troops are there to protect the status quo, the U.S. neocolonial status of Haiti. Haiti, I could say it's shared by three imperial powers, the U.S., France, which was the original colonial power, of course, and then Canada, who is a sort of junior partner and who has a lot of interests in Haiti for its mineral wealth, as we've discussed on this program, particularly gold. Canada is, of course, a big mining. A lot of their ruling groups have interests in mining. So those three nations really are the patrons, we could say, of this mercenary force. And, you know, Eutrice, it's really not that different than what Napoleon used back in the day. You know, we think of French troops being sent to Haiti, but in fact, it was kind of a United Nations they used then, too. They had Hessians, they had Poles, they had Italians, they had Spanish, they had all kinds of mercenary and freelance troops, which they would send to fight the wars in the colonies under Napoleon. And we see essentially the modern-day Napoleons, the Bill Clintons, using same template.
So in this transition period, what are the issues that are concerning Haitians right now?
Well, essentially Haiti, because of its vanguard role as the first independent nation of Latin America and the first black republic in the world, it has a very deep patriotic and a great attachment to its sovereignty. And so when you have these foreign forces come in and essentially trample Haitian sovereignty, that doesn't go over very well with Haitians on all levels of society. But, you know, worse still is the immunity that these groups have. They have gone into, just to do a quick thumbnail of their rule in Haiti in 1995 and 2005 and 2006, they carried out terrible massacres in Cité Soleil and in Bel Air, where they essentially had to repress the resistance to the coup d'etat of 2004. Cité Soleil and Bel Air was where many of the pro-Aristide, and we could say patriotic, forces in the poor, they made bases in those vast shanty towns, and the UN basically went in at U.S. prodding, and we've shown this all in Haiti Liberté through the WikiLeaks documents that we'd received from the U.S. Embassy. They were U.S. Embassy cables. They were prodding these UN troops to go in and massacre the people, which they did. And then on top of that, you have the incredible sexual predation, which went on. And in fact, there was just this past week, Paisley Dodd of the AP got an internal UN report, and it basically shows that the UN sexual crimes committed against the Haitian people. These are kids, you know, teenagers, 14, 15, 16, boys and girls, that these UN troops ended up raping in many cases, sometimes gang rapes. And so you have these troops getting away with this. They enjoy complete immunity, what we could really say is impunity, and nobody goes to jail for this. They are able to simply, you know, commit these heinous crimes and walk away. And this is just now on the sexual level. We could talk about all the testing that they're doing. We see them, you know, dropping this mother of all bombs, as they call it, in Afghanistan this past week. Well, you know, Haiti has also been a sort of testing ground for weapons. The Brazilians came in and were testing their weapons there. The Brazilians more or less headed the UN force in Haiti over these past 13 years. As we can see, the cholera was brought in. This, we could say, is the number one crime of this force. The Nepalese soldiers stationed in Mirabalais up at the headwaters of the Artibonite River let their sewage flow into the river. It was laced with cholera, and the cholera spread throughout the country. Well, what did they do? They now made a lemon out of lemonades. They said, okay, well, now we're going to give the country so-called vaccines against cholera. Well, that's ridiculous, because cholera is not a virus. Vaccines are for viruses. Cholera is a bacterial
infection.
It's a bacterial infection. How do you do it? You separate sewage from drinking water. It's that simple. It would cost maybe $10 million to do this in Haiti, to rebuild the sanitation systems. They don't use it. Instead, they're spending this past year $346 million to keep these 3,200 troops, soldiers and police, in Haiti. And yet they don't have the money to rebuild the sanitation system. Even now, the UN is asking for $400 million over the next 2 years to eradicate cholera in Haiti, the cholera that they brought. But how much have they actually managed to raise? 2 million of the 400 million. Not even 1%, so 0.05%. So this shows you just how cynical and outrageous this occupation is. So none of this is lost on the Haitian people. They're very clear on what these troops are doing and what their purpose is, and they want them out. As Marlene Bastien of Haitian Women of Miami said, my word to the peacekeepers, so-called peacekeepers, bon voyage and good riddance. So the Haitians basically want them out. And, you know, it's going to be one more struggle that I think maybe Haiti will again be the first nation to perhaps defeat and oust these proxy force that's known as a UN peacekeeping force.
Well, we leave it there today, Kim, hoping, of course, that you'll be back soon enough to give us a really comprehensive look at the landscape and the stories that you have been following for so many years. But this particular one, I think we both agree, is a kind of landmark in the sense that so many things are coming together. And all these stories are all intertwined, and so they need some space to be told. Thanks so much for being with us today and on such short notice, too. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Eutrice, and thank you for always keeping Haiti in the forefront. And people can check HaitiLiberté.com for any stories in English that they might like to follow.
Great. Thanks. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. Again, we all look at how things are connected. Here's Haiti all the way in the Caribbean, and there is Syria, and there is Afghanistan, and there is North Korea. What could they possibly have in common? You see how it works? We have another, we just were told of the, but we've covered pieces of it, the misbehavior of President Clinton. I mean, if you really want to get to know about the sinister activities of the Clintons, you really need to tune in to what's going on in Haiti and their role in Haiti. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today, and I hope it was informative and causes you to think. Don't rush to believe anything. Don't rush to believe anything. There are all kinds of stories that need to be told. But for the moment, the other side has overwhelming advantages in the sense that they have captured the principles involved. They have captured the media. So the stories that we get are kind of twisted or inadequate, very short on facts, or we get no information at all. But I do want to emphasize to you that keep your mind straight, because it's your only line of defense here. You got to keep your head on that you are, and we all are, we're targets. We are targets as well. So we always have to be on alert that we are targets. They're aiming for our brains. They want to capture our brains out so that we think what they want us to think. But if you take your time, calm down, take your time, look at things and ask logical questions, and you'll find that you'll be covering a lot of ground just by doing that. You'll be preparing yourself to steel yourself against the onslaught of propaganda. Coming up next, what's coming up next? I used to memorize these things, but now I have it written down, so I'm going to go a sign of age. Yes, Infectious Myth by David Crow. I will again memorize these things. Infectious Myth by David Crow, a very, very good and informative program. You can reach me via email at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program. A pleasure always. and a great privilege. I mean that. A great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
For the others to fire and sit